Tonight's Shaila is actually one that was posed last week at the Shir by Joey Adler. So if he comes in, let him know that this is in response to his question from last week. Last week, what we talked about was how one is supposed to light Shabbos candles when going to a hotel. And in the context of that discussion, we spoke about a general conversation about what is one to do bizman hazeh, nowadays, in our generation, when we have electric lights, and that would really flood the lights that are going to come out from the small candles that are going to be lit as the Shabbos candles. What do you do about that? So that's what we spoke about. And Joey Adler raised a very, very important question, and that is, but the minhag is, and this is what the Mesorah has been, that our great-grandmothers and our great-great-grandmothers and all those who came before them always lit Shabbos candles. They lit a candle. So how can you tell me that you're in fulfillment of the mitzvah of Halakas Ne'er Shabbos when you turn on the electric lights? That is not at all similar to the mitzvah of Halakas Ne'er Shabbos, and it's not really at all in line with what the Mesorah and the Minhag has been. And I think that that's a very important point that he raises, and that's what I wanted to address tonight. When we talk about Minhagim, we have to first preface the conversation with how important Minhagim are, and then we'll transition into a part of the conversation, time permitting, to explain when Minhagim perhaps might have to change and under which circumstances. So let's just begin the conversation as follows. It's well known that the Chasam Sofer and those who came following his kind of train of thought, the Ksav Sofer, who was his son, and Rabbi Kiva Eger, who was also the father-in-law of the Chasam Sofer, lived at the same time. So all of those, but mostly, most prominently, the Chasam Sofer was living at a time when there was a tremendous disdain for Orthodox Jewry. And he felt that he had to uphold tradition, and he had to do everything he could. It became very famous in the words of the Chasam Sofer in one of his tshuvas, where he writes, Chadash Asa Min HaTorah. Rav Asher Weiss pointed out to me that people often mistakenly quote that line of the Chasam Sofer. Now, that's really a play on words. The Gemara says, Chadash Asa Min HaTorah means, Chadash means the new produce is not allowed to be eaten. The Chasam Sofer borrowed that term to say that to institute new things into the Jewish religion, into the Jewish practice, into our minhagim, and to change that which was, would be a violation of Chadash Asur Min HaTorah, which again is a play on the words from what the Gemara originally meant, but that's the way he used it. Rav Asher Weiss pointed out to me once that, again, I'm not proficient enough in all of the tshuvas of the Chasam Sofer to have this insight, but he is, and he said if you count up all the times where the Chasam Sofer writes this line of Chadash Asur Min HaTorah, you will notice something very fascinating. The way it is used today, borrowing the term from the Chasam Sofer, who borrowed it from the Gemara, the way it's used today is up. If somebody wants to start a new minhag in a shul, and it's something that we don't do, let's say the Reform movement wants to take down a machitza, you know, 150 years ago, so Chasam Sofer is going to scream, Chadash Asur Min HaTorah, you're not allowed to do that. That's not what we do. You can't institute new minhagim. Maybe that was a bad example because there are other reasons why not, but whatever. You want to start playing music in the synagogue. You can have all kinds of good reasons why it should be mutter. Amir la'akob on Shabbos, and it's only a shvus, and it's only d'rabbanan, and it's a shvus to shvus. B'makom mitzvahs kabbalah Shabbos, and mitzvahs, whatever. You can come up with all kinds of rationalizations, and they actually make sense. So the Chasam Sofer would argue, Chadash Asur Min HaTorah, and therefore we cannot do this. And that's the way it's used in our generation as well. If someone wants to claim that instituting a new practice would be something that is not appropriate, you would say, Chadash Asur Min HaTorah. Rav Asher Weiss pointed out that if you look in the Chasam Sofer, he has a number of tshuvas where he uses this phrase of Chadash Asur Min HaTorah, but more often than not, he uses the phrase in the opposite direction, that you don't have a right to be machmir on the community and come up with a new chumrah because Chadash Asur Min HaTorah. Once in a while, the Chasam Sofer used it in the opposite direction to say, you don't have a right to be makel and play music in the shul, or other things like that. I don't remember the exact examples, but something of that nature. So he writes Chadash Asur Min HaTorah there as well. So Rav Asher Weiss pointed out that today we should apply the Chasam Sofer's logic in both directions as well. To make up new chumras that are not well-founded would also be a violation of Chadash Asur Min HaTorah, just like in the other direction, to make up new kulas that are not well-founded would not be appropriate either. Anyway, the Chasam Sofer is quoted in the Sefer Chut HaMeshulash, which is a biography of three different great people. That's why it's called Chut HaMeshulash. It's about the Chasam Sofer, his father-in-law, Rabbi Kiva Eger. It was his father-in-law from a second marriage. His wife passed away, and then he married the daughter of Rabbi Kiva Eger. I think they were 1 or 2 years apart, so he was very close in age to his father-in-law. And then his son, the Ksav Sofer. So somebody wrote the family history about all three of them, and in there he writes, why is it that the Chasam Sofer and all those who came following him all those who followed in his kind of position of leadership, why were they so staunch about the Minhagim? Why did this bother them so much? And he explains as follows, V'tama u'mamasho, shehikbid kol kach al Minhagi Yisrael. Why was the Chasam Sofer so insistent on Minhagi Yisrael? Yan ki hema gidarim usyagim l'gufei ha-Torah. Because he felt that Minhagi Yisrael are really the safeguards of the entirety of Torah. This is what keeps the boundary. If we're going to start breaking down Minhagim, then we're going to start moving the goalposts further and further and further. In the end, we're going to end up violating the laws of the Torah itself. And he says, Kimosha Goldrin kol bayis leman lo yavo ha-partzim miyad ala bayis penima. The same way we have a fence around the property so that people won't come in and steal anything from my backyard. So too he says, Kena davar azeh, that the Chachamim in every generation put up a goalpost. They put up boundaries to make sure that we would not come to do anything that would be an absolute violation of the Torah law itself. And that is why the Chasam Sofer felt we have to be sticklers on the Minhagim. He then writes further, Minhagi Yisrael Torah Hema. I believe that Minhagi Yisrael are not just an addendum to the Torah itself. A Minhag Yisrael is considered to be like the Torah itself. It is so fundamental to our experience as Jews. We need to appreciate what the Minhagim are all about. So that is what he said. And the Chasam Sofer himself writes in one of the tshuvas, Ragal ani lomar, kol mefakfek alani musim uminhagenu, tzarech bedika acharav. The Chasam Sofer said, people who question the Minhagim, doesn't mean you question them to understand them. It means you question them and then reject them. So the Chasam Sofer said, if you come across people who question and then reject Minhagim just because they don't understand them or they don't appreciate them, Sarach Badika Acharav, you have to really look into that individual and make sure that he is a upstanding Erlich person, because if you don't understand the value of Minhagim, you're going to be missing a lot of the value of Torah and mitzvahs itself. There's an amazing story told about Rabbi Akiva Eger, and the story goes as follows. And actually, it's funny, just a few minutes ago I had a meeting with a whole group of individuals, whatever, I don't want to give any identifying details, but we were talking about a bunch of different issues, and at one point they said that they were contacted by a shul somewhere, and the shul must have looked in the local phone book and saw that there was a Jewish organization, so they reached out to them, and they said, you know, we have a bunch of Torahs, how do we get rid of them? So he said, what do you mean you have a bunch of Torahs? Like, why do you want to get rid of them? He said, well, there was this synagogue here, it was a shul for so many years, and we don't really know what to do with it. Nobody's using these Torahs. So this individual felt that it was his responsibility. He went to this shul, and he saw there was no mechitza there, so it was clearly not an Orthodox synagogue. But who knows? The Torahs could be kosher. And they gave him two or three Sifrei Torah. Comes back here. He goes to the local sofer, and he brings the Torahs in. Now, he's not experienced enough in sofers to know what's right and what's wrong. But he shows him to the sofer, and within 5 minutes, he saw right away that obviously this is not a Sefer Torah that was written by a kosher sofer. And the halacha is, Sefer Torah shekasvo min, if you have a Sefer Torah that is written by an apikoris, tzarech lisrof, you have to burn it. It's not just that you can't use it in shul to do the Kriyas HaTorah, you have to actually burn it. So he says, now I'm at the sofer with these two Sefer Torah, what am I going to do? Make a big bonfire outside and burn the Sefer Torah? Like, what am I supposed to do? Anyway, he handed it off to the sofer and said, you take care of it. I was trying to do a good tovah for the Jewish community. I didn't want to get stuck with this. Anyway, that's what ended up happening. So the story with Rabbi Akiva Eger was as follows. There was once a Sefer Torah that was found in a shul or somewhere, and nobody really knew the origins of where the Sefer Torah had come from. Now, how are you going to ascertain, how are you going to figure out whether the Sefer Torah was written by a sofer who is a kosher, or the Sefer Torah was written by a Sefer Torah who's an apikoros? How would you know? How is one supposed to know? So, if he's missing letters and missing words and things aren't right, so then you know. But let's say the sofer did an excellent job. It just so happens to be, he's not from. He could be an artist. He can follow the script of another Sefer Torah. He can make sure to copy it exactly the way it was. So, what would you do? Just looking for a box of tissues. Yeah. Thank you. What would you do in a situation like that, thank you, where you find the Sefer Torah and you don't know the origins of where the Sefer Torah actually originated from? So what is one supposed to do? They came to Rabbi Akiva Eger, and they said, our community has found the Sefer Torah, and we don't know what to do. Should we use it to lay in the shul, or should we assume that this was a Sefer Torah that was written by a sofer who is an unacceptable sofer? That was a shaila. And the answer Rabbi Akiva Eger said is as follows. Let's turn to the last column of the Sefer Torah, and let's look. What does the last column look like? They didn't understand. What are you looking at? He looks at the last column and he says, this Sefer Torah needs to be burnt. What did he see in the last column? He said, the Minig Yisrael always has been for the last few hundred years that when we finish off a Sefer Torah, what do? We invite many other people to come to the house or to come to the shul, and they all participate in finishing off the last few sentences, the last few lines of the Sefer Torah. There's no way that the Sofer, who wrote everything in such a symmetrical fashion and everything was so perfect, there's no way that when you have hundreds of people gathered around and everyone's writing a little bit, that that's going to come out the same way. It's going to be a little crooked, going to be a little ink sticking out. So he said, from the fact that the last paragraph is just as perfectly straight as the rest of the paragraphs in the Sefer Torah, it must be that this was written by a apikoros. Why? Because they obviously didn't follow the Minhag Yisroel. If they followed the Minhag Yisroel, which would have been to have everybody come and participate in the writing of the Torah at the end, then it would never be straight. And from that alone, Rabbi Akiva Eiger Paskin, Sefer Torah has to be burnt. Amazing. It's a pella. An amazing psak of Rabbi Akiva Eiger. But it's something that shows how prominent a place Minhagim play. So much so that we take it to the extreme that Rabbi Akiva Eiger was prepared to say that we should burn a Sefer Torah based on the lack of somebody following a minhag, which is amazing. So the Rama actually in Hilchos Yom Na'araim, in Hilchos Rosh Hashanah, Siman Tav Reish Yud Tes, sorry, that's Hilchos Yom Kippur. So the Rama is in the 1500s, and he writes, quoting from the Maharil. The Maharil was the father of Chachmei Ashkenaz, lived in the 1400s, and the Rama took so much of the psak for Ashkenazic Jewry from the Maharil who came before him. So the Rama writes as follows. When he talks about davening Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, he says, Al Yishana Adam Miminag Ha'ir, nobody should change the minhagim of the city. Afilu b'nigunim o b'piyutim sha'omrim sham. Don't tamper with the machzer. Don't change the nusach. Don't change anything. So if the nusach is something that is not working for people and nobody's feeling connected to it, so of course you change it. But you have a chazan who just gets up one year and decides he wants to change the nusach just because he learned a new piece of chazanus and it's not something that people are familiar with and it's not something that people appreciate. So why would you do that? Says the Rama, you don't have a right to do it. Because that is changing from the minhag. Okay, if you just read this Rama, you'd say, all right, that doesn't sound like the biggest deal. Let's look at the original comment of the Maharil, where this comes from. What's the story? The Maharil says as follows. Don't change the minhag at all, even when it comes to the nigunim, or when it comes to the piyutim that we say, just leave everything as is. Sipar lanu maisa ba'atzmo. The Maharil said a story about himself. This can be found in the Sefer Minhagei Maharil, which is a very credible source, where he says that he was the Shliach Tzibur when he came to Regensburg, B'yomim Hanarayim, B'yominagin kolat tfila, K'minag medinas Ostreich. So he came from the town Ostreich. He was now, for whatever reason, Yom Na'araim, he was in Regensburg. They were so excited to have such a chashuv about tfila, the Maharil, he gets up to Davin, and instead of asking the Gabayim, what do you do here, which negunim do you sing, and which ones do you say, he decided he's going to do everything like the minig in his town. And it bothered him. He made a whole commotion that they were relating to Haftorah with a certain, certain tune. And he said, he said, we're going to add this piyut and we're going to take out that one. And the Gabbaim kept coming over to him in the middle of davening and saying, what are you doing? This is not what we do. We skip this page, we do that page, and everything's out of order and you're not doing it properly. We don't say all of these things that you're saying, and you're skipping things that we do say, and you're singing things differently, and nothing's the way we normally have it. And he said, no, I'm not going to listen. Why? Because you're doing it wrong. That's what he said. Listen what he says. That's what it says. Mesa basara v'yom kippur. This was on Rosh Hashanah. The Maharil's daughter passed away on Yom Kippur. The Maharil, nobody said it to him. He said about himself that he felt that that was an onesh, which sounds very extreme, but he felt that that was an onesh for him coming to town and changing the minhagim against the wishes of the leaders of the community. Fascinating story. Frightening story. And again, don't get the mistaken impression like next time you see that somebody passes away in a tragic way, you should tell them, oh, it's because you did this or that. Terrible thing to do, and probably not the right thing to do. And who are we to decide why things happen? But the Maharil said about himself that he felt the reason why he was punished was because he was tampering with the minhagim. So there's a similar story with the Aruch HaShulchan and the Netziv, where they have the following discussion. It's very hard to justify why it is that we don't do Nesias Kapayim here in Chutz La'aretz every single day. The Torah says that a Kohen has an obligation to give a bracha to the Jewish people. It doesn't say it should only be on Yom Tov. It sounds like it should be all the time. So why do we not duchen? So the Aruch HaShulchan writes as follows. V'hidein v'adai ein shum tam nachal leminhagenu levato mitzvah haseh debirchas kohanim kol hashana kula. There's actually no justification, there's no rationale, there's no defense for why we do not do Nesias Kapayim every single day. U'mina garuahu. It's a terrible thing. Why are we mevata la mitzvah every single day that we don't have the Kohanim getting up to give us a bracha? Aval, ma nase, writes the Aruch HaShulchan, what should we do? Ki ilu bas kol yatsa shelo lahaniach lanu lisa kapayim echal hashana kula. We have no halachic way of justifying the practice why we don't do Nesias Kapayim every day. But what should I do? It's as if a heavenly voice came out and instructed us not to do Nesias Kapayim. So what's he talking about? What's this basko? Anybody knows the story? That's part of the story. So the Netziv actually writes about this in a tshuva, and he says, we have a family tradition. I'll tell you exactly what happened. He says, my family, the Netziv's family, was part of the Volozhin family, and they had a tradition from the family of Reb Chaim Volozhiner from the Vilna Gaon. Reb Chaim Volozhiner was the greatest Talmud of the Vilna Gaon. So he says, the story goes as follows. One day, the Vilna Gaon decided, this makes no sense. Why do we not have Nesias Kapayim every day? We're going to start duchening every day. Hung up signs. Tomorrow morning, we're going to start changing the minhag in the shul, and we're going to start having Nesias Kapayim. And we're told that that night, the Vilna Gaon was arrested, and he was thrown into jail. And he said, that was obviously a simon min hashamayim, that this is not the proper thing for me to be doing, even though he had a million reasons halachically to explain why he was doing what he was doing, but obviously the minig is the minig, and that's why we're going to leave it the way it is. Fine. Reb Chaim Volozhiner comes along a couple of years later. Vilna Gaon passes away. Chaim Volozhiner says, maybe the time wasn't right in the days of the Vilna Gaon, but I know my Rebbe the Vilna Gaon very much believed in this. He wanted us to start doing the Nesias Kapayim. So Reb Chaim Volozhiner hangs up signs that they were going to go and change the minig and start doing the Nesias Kapayim every day. What happened? That night, writes the Netziv, they have a family tradition that night, Nisraf Chatzi Ha'ir U'Beis HaKnesset Sheba'ir. Half of the city burnt down in a fire, and one of the houses that burnt down was the shul. And Reb Chaim Volozhiner said, I don't know how to explain this, but it seems HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't want us to be doing this. HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't want us to be doing it. So the Aruch HaShulchan just gives you the short end of the story, which is, we don't understand why, but it sounds like a baskel min hashamayim came out and told us, don't change the minhag. That's what he's referring to. He's referring to these two stories of the Vilna Gaon and Reb Chaim Volozhiner, who both came to the same conclusion, that even though it makes sense to change the minhag, it would seem that HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't want them to do so. So minhagim are certainly very, very important. And that's why I think Joey's question is a very valuable one. Why is it, if our grandmothers and our great-grandmothers and all those who came before them always lit Shabbos candles in one way, how can you come along now and change the minhag? How can you say now that we're going to light Shabbos candles in a different way than we always used to? Isn't that a violation of being Mishana the Minhagim? Great question. So what I want to explain is as follows. My father loves to talk about this because it's a theme that he very much appreciates. The Torah says in Parshas Toldos, we read a lot about Avraham Avinu, a whole lot about Yaakov Avinu and his family. We have very little in the Torah that describes the life of Yitzchak. Yitzchak seems like a very passive, so to speak, person. Yitzchak was brought up onto the Akedah. Again, Rashi explains that he was enthusiastic, he was excited to go along with his father, but from the Psukim it seems, Yitzchak just goes along with everything. And his whole life, we don't see Yitzchak doing such dramatic, such drastic actions. We don't read so much about his accomplishments. What was it about Yitzchak that made him unique? So the Torah says, Vayachbar be'eros amayim asher chafru b'mei Avraham Avinu, that Yitzchak came along, and he dug the wells that his father Avraham Avinu had dug out. Vayikra lehem shemos kishemos asher kar lehen aviv. And he called the wells the same names that his father referred to the wells as well. Now, the Mefarshim say, what it's trying to teach us is that Yitzchak's greatest milah was that he followed in the Mesorah of his father. He followed the Minhagim, everything his father did, he did as well. My father always likes to say that sometimes when you have a genius, so it would not be helpful if the students of that genius also wanted to show what geniuses they are. The smartest thing for them to do is to take all the brilliance that they got from that genius teacher and just share it with the Hamonam and figure out how to share it in a way that people can actually appreciate. If they're going to want to show the world their own brilliance, then all of that is going to be lost from what they got from their teacher. So that's what he often likes to say. Yitzchak Avinu's job was, my father was a maverick. My father came into the world and he taught everybody about monotheism and he had all these wild ideas that nobody thought of until him. What's my job? What's the best way for me to spend my life? Is to make sure that the world will appreciate the legacy of who my father was. Otherwise, it's all going to be lost. And Yitzchak spends his life making sure to carry on the tradition, making sure the Mesorah remains strong, and making sure that he does everything exactly in the way in which his father did it as well. Okay. Now, Rashi quotes in the Medrash the following problem. What does Yitzchak do? Vayhi rav ba'aretz. There's a famine in the land. So what does Yitzchak do? So he looks back in the family history book and he finds the page. What did my father Avraham Avinu do when there was a famine in the land of Eretz Yisrael? He went down to Mitzrayim. Okay, so I should follow the Mesorah. I should follow the Minhag. This is what we do. So he packs his bags and he starts traveling down to Mitzrayim. HaKadosh Baruch Hu stops him in the way and he says, no, absolutely not. You can't go. Yitzchak says, what do you mean? I'm following the Mesorah. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to him, no, you got it wrong. You see, your father was not an Ola Tamima. Your father didn't have an elevated status as a Karban. You were bound up on the Akedah, which gave you the special status of being a Karban. Once you're a Karban, you're not allowed to leave Eretz Yisrael. You have to stay here. Your father was allowed to leave because he didn't have the same status as you had. And Yitzchak responds and he says, no, but I'm just following the Minhag. So what's the answer? How do you explain the answer to Yitzchak? The answer is, my father explains, that if your father had the same set of circumstances as you now have, he also wouldn't have left Mitzrayim. The only reason why your father left Mitzrayim is because he had one set of circumstances. Now the circumstances, what? Oh, thank you. The reason why your father left Eretz Yisrael is because he didn't have the same circumstances as you. Imagine Avraham Avinu was an Ola Tamima. He also wouldn't have left Eretz Yisrael. So by you saying, I'm going to blindly follow exactly what my father did, that's not following the Mesorah. That's not following the Minhag. Because your father never would have done this if these would have been his set of circumstances. So what my father proves from this is, you have to look at every situation and look at this particular that I'm confronted with and ask myself, is this exactly the same as the situation that my father experienced in his life? Is this the same as what the minhag always was? I'm doing the same action, but maybe that action is not appropriate for this set of circumstances. I'll give you another example. The Gemara says in Maseches Sanhedrin, Yoshua ben Nun goes out to battle. After the war is almost finished, what happens? What does he say? He makes a cheirem. What does he say? A cheirem means everything's off limits. And he tells all the Jewish soldiers, everybody who's there, nobody's allowed to take from the spoils of war. No one's allowed to touch it. Where did Yoshua ben Nun get this idea from? Why would he say that? I'm entitled, I'm a soldier, we won the war, I can take what I want. So why is he making a cheirem? So Rashi says there, the reason why is because, looks back to his Rebbe Moshe Rabbeinu. We follow the minhag. So he says, my Rebbe Moshe Rabbeinu, when we fought a war, told us not to take from the spoils of war. So when I'm now the general of the army and I'm fighting the war, I'm going to tell the soldiers the same thing. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, you're going to be punished for this. The Gemara in Sanhedrin writes that Yoshua ben Nun in the end lost the war because of the cheirem that he made. And Yoshua turns back to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and he says, what do you want from me? I did exactly what Moshe Rabbeinu did. I'm following the Mesorah. What's the answer? The Gemara says there was a major difference. In the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, there was no din of Arvus yet. There was no din of Kol Yisrael Areivim Zeh Bazeh. I wasn't responsible for you, you weren't responsible for me. Once they came into Eretz Yisrael, now the din of Arvus set in. Oh, once the din of Arvus sets in, is a whole different story. Because if somebody violates the cheirem, It's no longer that person's problem alone. It's now all of our problem. And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Yehoshua ben Nun, you're not following the Mesorah. Moshe Rabbeinu, had he been in this set of circumstances, with arvus on the entire Jewish people, he never would have put a cherem on, because he knows how dangerous that can be. You didn't look carefully enough into the actions of Moshe Rabbeinu. The only reason why Moshe Rabbeinu put a cherem in his generation is because Moshe Rabbeinu said, if one Jew does something wrong, it's his problem, he'll be punished. If another Jew does something wrong, it's his problem, he'll take it up with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now that all of us are arevim zeh lazeh, now that we all have responsibility for each other, not so pashut. And Moshe Rabbeinu himself never would have done that. And therefore, what it means to follow the Mesorah sometimes means that you have to look carefully at the set of circumstances. So in Shulchan Aruch Yerudei, it has the following scenario. Yerudei Siman Kuf Beis, the Shulchan Aruch writes, what happens if you have a pot that has to be koshered? The pot, we cook treif in it, basar b'chalav, whatever it is, we made a mistake, milchik, fleishiks, pot is totally treif. And now this pot gets mixed up with all the other pots, and I can't remember anymore which one it is. So what's the halacha? What's the halacha? What do I do? Well, there's two options. What are the two options? Either kosher everything, which is going to be a big hassle, a pain in the neck. I have to take all my pots out and go kosher everything. Or option B is apply the principle of bittul barov, which means when I have two pieces of meat, three pieces of meat, one of them is treif and two of them are kosher and something non-kosher gets mixed in, I say bittul barov. So maybe I should say the same thing here. Each pot that I take out to use, maybe this is the one, that's fine. So maybe I don't have to worry about it. So why shouldn't I use bittul barov? Why shouldn't I use bittul barov? The argument not to rely upon bittul barov is because the Shulchan Aruch has another principle from the Gemara in Beitza that davar sheyesh lematirin, we don't say bittul barov. If there's an easy way to get out of the problem, then why would you rely on bittul barov? Now there's an easy way to get out of the problem. What's the easy way? Just kosher it. So why would you just rely on, oh, maybe this is the right pot, maybe it's the wrong pot. Just assume that all of them are treif and go kosher everything. What's the big deal? Says the Shulchan Aruch, no. Since it's such a tircha meruba and it's going to cost you so much money to go get water and to make a fire and to go through all of the hassle to be koshering all the pots, therefore we say bittul barov is something that is appropriate in this situation. So Rav Soloveitchik said, maybe that was in the days of the Shulchan Aruch before they had running water, and before they had an oven, and before they had an easy way to do a koshering. But bizman hazeh, in our generation, where, again, it is a shtickel tircha to have to kosher all the pots, but it's not such a big deal. It doesn't cost me anything. Again, water costs some money. Making a fire costs me a little bit. The gas bill, the electric bill, all right. But you figure it out. It's not so bad. We waste plenty of money on other things. More money than that. So Rav Soloveitchik said the halacha will change. Aye, but what do you mean? I have a memory of my Alta Zeta that when they had a treifa pot, they didn't kosher it. The answer is yeah, because back then, they didn't have running water. And they had to have someone going to schlep the water all the way from the well to the house. Someone is going to put up a fire and make a whole scene out of this. Of course, your Zeta didn't kosher the pot because it was too much of a tircha, it was too much money. But the situation changed. It doesn't mean we're changing the minhagim. It means you have to think, what would my Zeta have done if he was in my situation today, and he had the set of circumstances that I'm looking at? My father always quotes from Rav Schwab, that Rav Schwab was the Rav in Breuers, where people are, you know, very proper and very put together. And he said he remembers there was once a Chassidish Yid who was in Washington Heights on a business, a real estate, whatever it was, and he got stuck for mincha. So he runs into the shul, and he comes to sit down to daven mincha with everybody, and he noticed as this man took off his tie and quickly wrapped it around his waist as a gartel. So Rav Schwab didn't say anything. It's not his place to say anything. But afterward, he commented how funny he thought it was. What's the reason why we wear a gartel? What's that about? Separate top and bottom. Why? What? Yeah, you have clothing on, right? So we wear pants. We wear you wear a skirt. You wear clothing. So why do you need a gartel? So the reason why is because the Gemara says Hikon Nikros Elokecha Yisrael. We should do something to show that we're preparing for davening. So I walk around all day in these clothing. For davening, I should put on something special. For davening, I should show I'm doing something out of the ordinary to prepare myself to have an engaging conversation with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay, so we put on a gartel. That's why the Chassidim put on a gartel. Nu, so what's more appropriate? If I'm wearing a tie, right, and it says that you're supposed to stand in front of the Melech Malchei Amlachem HaKadosh Baruch Hu as the way you would stand in front of a king or a prince or a president or a prime minister, then what makes the most sense? If I'm already wearing a tie, should I take it off and wrap it around my waist? Of course not. Rav Schwab said, the first thing you should do is put a tie on for davening to show that you have so much respect for the davening. If you already have the tie and now you have an extra piece of cloth, so then you put it around the zagartel. So Rav Schwab said, aye, but what's the Chassidish Yid going to say back? Well, what do you mean? My Zeta always wore a gartel. He would never think of davening mincha without a gartel. So he said, yeah, it's true. But the circumstance changed. Now that we have ties that are considered to be a respectable way to stand in front of a melech, so now you have to wear a tie. You don't wear the gartel. Not to the exclusion, but if you only have a choice of one, you have to look at the situation and ask yourself, what would my Zeta have done if he were in the situation that I'm in today? And the same goes with the Shaila that we started with. How can we even think about changing the way that we approach the discussion of Hadlakas Neir Shabbos today? You're going to tell me that if I flick a switch and I turn on a light bulb, that's considered to be Lahadik Neir Shal Shabbos? How can it be? My Baba and my Zeta and all those who came before me never did that? The answer is yeah, that's because they didn't have electric lights. Had they been living in our generation and they did have electric lights, maybe things would have been different and we have to reevaluate. And that's why the poskim of the last generation are all struggling to figure out what's the right thing to do now that the whole circumstance has changed? Now that we're looking at a very different reality, how do we confront that? How do we deal with it? And that's really something that's very important. When we talk about Minhagim, it's not just blindly following every single thing that was done before us. It's something that really needs to look at a very careful consideration of what each of the Minhagim were about, why they were instituted, what the circumstances were, and whether or not that still applies today. Now, sometimes that requires a major chacham to be able to break all that down and figure out what it's about. But when the Chachamim actually sit down and figure it out, then that would be something that is absolutely not in violation of what the Minhagim are, but rather upholding the Minhagim. It shows we are doing exactly what our grandparents would have done had they been alive today to have this set of circumstances that we are experiencing. Okay.